My guest this morning is a classic rags-to-riches story. Dan Brown went to Hollywood to make it as a musician, but ended up writing instead. After publishing a couple of books that went nowhere, he wrote a book you might have heard of. Yeah, you might have come across it once or twice. A book called The Da Vinci Code. And Dan Brown became one of the best-known authors in the world. The success of the mega-selling novelist continues. And with his eighth book, Origin, readers say Dan Brown clearly has the magic touch. I sat down with Dan Brown.
Jack Tame.
Good morning.
Origin explores two pretty fundamental questions. Where do we come from and where are we going? You weren't tempted to go with lighter stuff this time around.
No, I guess I don't do light. I mean, these books are supposed to be a lot of fun. They're thrillers and they're adventures, but at the core of all these books, there's ideally a big, tough question.
Yeah. You do deal with the tough questions. Does that mean that when you're not writing, you give yourself a bit of a break from them, or is this the sort of stuff you entertain yourself with all the time?
You know what? I grew up in a house, with a couple of teachers. My parents were teachers. I grew up on the campus of a school where we were always thinking as much as possible. And I guess I just I enjoy learning. I enjoy pondering. So I wouldn't say it's my downtime is usually reading something else difficult.
Yeah. What do you read?
I read almost exclusively nonfiction. Right now I'm reading Life 3.0 about artificial intelligence. But I read, science and philosophy and history and religion, all sorts of things.
And you do get pleasure from reading still?
Oh, I do. I do. And that's, and I hope that these books do the same, for others. I always love hearing that, especially for people who haven't read a lot or don't read a lot, that they, that these books, these Robert Langdon thrillers are the one book in the year that they sort of jump to. It's great.
Can you give us, without giving too much away, can you give us a bit of detail on how Robert Langdon has developed since we last saw him?
Well, at the beginning of Origin, he has been called to the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao. That's sort of spectacular modern art museum. And he is there to hear a former student, who is now a brilliant futurist, make an announcement. And this futurist has made a scientific discovery that he's about to announce. It's a discovery that he feels will shake the foundations of world religion. So there's a lot of concern about what he's about to say. And, of course, nothing goes quite as planned. And Langdon, as usual, has a long and miserable evening trying to sort it all out.
Yes, they're always long and miserable evenings. What was it about the Louvre, the Guggenheim, that really piqued your interest?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm sure many of your listeners have seen it. It is a very unique building. It's just it is spectacularly modern. It looks like something from another era, another planet, perhaps. And Langdon, he has no experience with modern art. He's a classicist, and, as he says in the book, I know a lot about Da Vinci and almost nothing about de Kooning. He is having to face a new kind of art in the same way that I did to write this book. And I think we've all had that experience where we go to a modern art museum, and even those of us who study art, you stand in front of a canvas that's all white except for a little red blob in the left-hand corner, and you think, I could have done that. Why is that art? And so Langdon sort of has to face some of those questions.
So did you spend a fair bit of time at the Guggenheim?
I did, yeah. I was very fortunate to spend time with the curator there and a number of curators, actually, and just really ask those questions. Why is this art? What makes this great art? Why is this worth, $10 million? And this thing over here worth nothing. Tell me the difference.
I found it a really affecting experience going to the Guggenheim, and I'm not someone who necessarily engages with modern art in a big way, but I found I knew so much about the building itself. I didn't know a whole lot about the exhibition, and particularly the permanent exhibition, but I found it to be a really affecting space, and that sort of has given you a bit of fodder.
Oh, it has. I've always thought of setting as an important character in these books, and certainly the opening of this book, readers are going to get a taste for the Guggenheim, for this sort of spectacular and very strange location, along with, we have fun looking at some of the art, and, Langen sort of, I wouldn't say makes fun of it, but he certainly makes fun of himself not being able to quite figure it out.
Yeah. I hope you don't mind me asking, what is your relationship in the real world with religion?
I grew up in a very religious household. My mother was a church organist, a church choir director. I sang in the choir. I grew up very Christian. And, I believed the story of Adam and Eve. I believed, the story of the resurrection and all of that. And when I was about 9 years old, I went to the Museum of Science in Boston, Massachusetts, and learned about evolution. And I went back to my priest and I said, wait, you told me Adam and Eve was how it happened. I've just learned this other story. Which story is true? And this priest said, nice boys don't ask that question. And that was really the moment for me when I started asking that question. Yeah, I did exactly what little boys do when they're told not to. I started asking that question as much as possible. It became the theme of my writing, just trying to understand the interplay between science and religion. And this book is no different. At the core of the book, there is this question of whether or not God will survive science. And historically, gods do not survive science. Historically, we used to have a whole pantheon of gods to describe the natural world. And when we saw the ebb and flow of the oceans, we said, well, that's Poseidon. His moods are shifting. And sooner or later, science stepped in and said, that's not Poseidon. That's gravity and the moon. And Poseidon evaporated. So the real question now, if you look at historically what has happened to the gods of the past as science increases, we have to ask ourselves if the gods of today will be here in the future. And is it naive to think somehow that our gods are special and enduring?
See, that is an interesting perspective given how much we are concerned as a society about fundamentalism in our religion at the moment. And I would have thought that you could almost make an argument in the opposite direction, saying that science is losing, for want of a better term, to religion in a battle for what is true or right, again, for want of a better term. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I actually would argue the exact opposite. I think that science, if you look at the young people in educated societies, it's impossible for young people to embrace religion and simultaneously embrace the technical world, which is increasingly their world. When I was growing up, our miracles were, they came from church.
Yeah.
They were the virgin birth and the resurrection and, the three wise men and all of that. But now increasingly kids, their miracles are, the new iPhone or the new operating system. Or, it's like that's where they find their magic.
And is that the same all around the world?
Clearly, in every religion, every philosophy, there are going to be pockets of extremism, pockets of fundamentalism. But yes, I would say in general terms, I'm certainly not telling you that there are not pockets of extreme belief. But I would also argue that in many cases, extremism has very little to do with religion. Unfortunately, religion is always, waved as a cause. Religion and God inspires people to do all sorts of things. Mm. And yet those actions have very little to do with the concept of spirituality or religion.
Well, often the extremism is more a result of economic marginalization or cultural marginalization or myriad other factors that are wearing a thin veil of religion on the very front.
I agree wholeheartedly, and if you just look at the question we ask, will God survive science? It's interesting because a lot of futurists believe that science will actually solve a lot of the world's big problems of scarcity or overpopulation. And the question is, if you could imagine a utopian future where these problems of scarcity and starvation and we just don't have enough are eradicated, would we have as much of a need for God? Or, would extreme religion exist if you had what you needed?
Yeah.
And I think most people would agree that it would diminish enormously.
Hey, did you see Leonardo da Vinci's last privately held paintings are going on sale?
I've received a few emails to that effect. I don't think I'm in the market.
Well, I think it's $100 million US dollars, I think was the estimate I saw going around. I'm not sure how good your how the publishing world is at the moment, but that might be out of reach.
I'm very fortunate, but let's just say that I will not be lining up to buy that painting.
are you still really, not obsessed, but are you still really into Leonardo da Vinci?
I am. In all candor, I kind of OD'd on Leonardo da Vinci after the Da Vinci Code, and certainly writing that book, just spent so much time with his work and with his life and all of that I've kind of moved on. And actually, writing Origin has gotten me quite interested in modern art, and I'm having fun with that.
Yeah, how do you find modern art compared to the more classical?
I find it challenging. I find it challenging in a really fun way that, you know, we can go to. I mean, if you go to the Louvre and you stand in the Grand Gallery, you can look at every painting there and say, well, this may not be my favorite painting in the Louvre, but I can see how it took a lot of skill to create it.
Yeah.
Whereas in a modern art museum, you know, every other thing you look at, you think, well, it's just a circle of rocks on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, I could have done that. And I actually said that to a curator, and the curator said, you know, but you didn't. Like, this person had the idea to do it, and you didn't. I've started to understand that modern art is about concept, not about the artifact. And it's kind of interesting.
And so, whereas you might not quite be in the market for a Da Vinci, you can look at a Jeff Koons blow-up dog and say, well, actually, maybe.
Sure, maybe, or better yet, I'll just make it myself.
Yeah, fair enough. Do you think there's a... I mean, the thing that makes Da Vinci so interesting is that, I mean, he is an almost unparalleled genius, at least in the context of our relatively recent history. Do you think there are Da Vinci types amongst us today? And the reason I ask that is I had a friend the other day describe Elon Musk from Tesla as kind of the 2017 version of Da Vinci.
I think that's an accurate portrayal. There have always been people in society who rise up and glimpse the future somehow, and in doing so, when they glimpse a future that is that piques our interest or we feel like we have use for, they become famous and powerful and influential. That's really what happened to Leonardo da Vinci, that he, you know, his inventions, his scientific thinking, you know, on top of all of his artistic ability, made him a leader. And that's exactly what's happening to Elon Musk. And, you know, there are others too, you know, Kurzweil, and even in some ways Jeff Bezos. I mean, just these people who are shaping our world in ways that we didn't really see coming. Certainly Steve Jobs was one of them.
Yeah. It is almost the gift of profound foresight, isn't it? And that foresight allows them to shape our world in enormous ways. Hey, I wanted to ask you very quickly, because I know you have to go, about your writing routine. Is it true that you take breaks and do press-ups next to your desk?
Yeah, that is true.
Really?
Very true. It's a sedentary job to write a book. And I just find that it keeps the blood going and helps me stay focused for more hours.
Wow. So what's a Dan Brown set? What's an hour's worth of writing worth in terms of press-ups?
Oh, very few. Nobody's going to mistake me for a bodybuilder, I'll tell you that much. It's just keeping the blood going, you know, a couple minutes.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on Origin, Dan. I know there will be many tens of millions of people around the world so excited to get their hands on a copy, and thank you for sparing us a bit of time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.